mic is working also. Okay, we've got quite a few people still coming in, so I think we'll just wait a second or so, well, maybe a minute or so to let people get settled, and then we'll start, okay? You can't hear? No? What happened to the mic? Now it's okay? It's me, not the mic. Oh. Okay, so does this work? In the back, but okay. In the front, does this work?
Yes, it does.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Sue.
Okay, welcome to workshop number 406. 405, actually, partnering to end the new Jim Crow. Thank you all for being here. My name is Sandy Hart, and I'm a member of the Social Justice Executive Council at First Unitarian Church here in Portland. I'm also a member of the steering committee of the Ending the New Jim Crow group at that same church. I see two of my fellow steering committee members in the auditorium. So Terry Martin and Catherine Scotton, you want to stand up and wave to everyone? Let's see. Yeah. So I don't see the other three members of our committee. Oh, there's Carol Witherall. Stand up. Oh, Isabel Sheridan works on our committee. So I think that's most of us. If I missed you, stand up and raise your hand. Okay. So thank you all for being here. And I really would like to introduce a special guest that's with us today. Teresa Rayford is an activist and organizer for Don't Shoot Portland and Black Lives Matter here. And we're just developing an on-the-ground relationship with Teresa, and the Social Ministry Department of the UUA helped us pay for Teresa's registration. So I just am so pleased with the way she's been welcomed. So thank you all. So we started an Ending the New Jim Crow group about 2 years ago after a book discussion by our senior minister, Bill Sinkford. And we took very seriously the responsibility of educating ourselves first. And we have done that through monthly meetings in our congregations, where community agencies have increased our knowledge base of the issues surrounding New Jim Crow. And we've put on several events that the whole community has been invited to. The first one, which is actually on YouTube, that you can look at, was a panel on ending the New Jim Crow and the war on drugs. And then we did a panel with several community partners on restorative justice and restorative practices in the schools. We've had the Multnomah County Youth Authority in to educate us about issues involving youth. Actually, Terry Martin helped set up a model program for the Annie Casey organization here in Multnomah County, and she'd be glad to talk to you about that. So, and then we had a local documentary called Arresting Power that was made here in Portland, and it traced 50 years of policing practices in Portland. And that is a hard and difficult movie to watch, and an important movie to see. They are showing it, screening it in other parts of the country. All of these resources will be on the UUA website, because we are in a sustainability model these days, and so the UUA will be posting our resources online for us. So watch for them probably a few days after GA. So the panelists today represent some of the partners we've worked with, and I'd like to introduce them to you. So the Reverend Kate Lohr is our social justice minister at First Unitarian. Kate graduated from the University of California at Santa Cruz and Meadville Lombard. She was ordained in 2007. But prior to that, she worked first as community outreach for the United Methodist Church in Portland, beginning in 1992. She then became the director of social justice at First Unitarian and served in that position from 1998 till 2007, when she became the social justice minister. Joanne Hardesty served as a state representative from 1995 to 2001. She's currently president of the Portland chapter of the NAACP and a member of the Albina Ministerial Alliance. Joanne is devoted to broad-based community organizing and is currently president of the Coalition for a Livable Future and a board member of Human Solutions. She has been and is a leader in demanding police accountability in the city of Portland. So. Shannon White has served the Partnership for Safety and Justice as deputy director for 7 years And the Partnership for Safety and Justice has led work in the Ban the Box in local jurisdictions in Oregon and won increased funding for both domestic and sexual violence victims, and also passed legislation, helped to pass legislation that has flatlined prison growth. Doug Cooper is the executive director of Mercy Corps Northwest, which is the only domestic program that Mercy Corps International operates. And they operate in Oregon and Washington. And he has operational responsibility for the Reentry Transition Center, which is this year's local service project. And I see some red shirts in the audience. Raise your hand, Chi. And these are people from the Reentry Transition Center. He also helps to coordinate ROAR, which is a reentry organization and resource alliance of 40 organizations. So now, I'd just like to know a little bit about you. Who's in the audience here? Are you looking to start a group? Raise your hand. So, some of you, okay. How many of you have already got a group started and going?
A group of what?
A group of Ending the New Jim Crow, sorry. An Ending the New Jim Crow group. Sorry. Okay. Okay, so are you the people who've got a group started? And then how many of you have been on the ground for a long time now and are really feeling that you're totally organized? Okay. Yeah. Okay, so we have chosen to present information about role models from this book, which unfortunately isn't available at GA, and I know you can't see it probably, but it's an organizing guide to building a movement to end the new Jim Crow by Daniel Hunter, and it will also be on the resource list. So now Joanne is going to talk about the model that's in that book.
Good afternoon. Okay, so you know I'm African-American, right? And we have a tradition in the African-American community, and it's kind of called the call and response. And so, like, when I say good afternoon, what I need is a lot of energy from you. So we're going to do that one more time, okay? All right. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right, we got Unitarians in the house. Welcome. Thank you for being here. And let me start, because it is rare for me to have an opportunity to publicly thank one of my community sheroes. And she's going to freak out when she finds out that I'm talking about Reverend Kate Lohr. Reverend Kate Lohr, if you don't know this woman, I didn't know what a social justice minister did until I met Kate Lohr. And let me tell you, a social justice minister does everything and anything and moves mountains and makes things happen. And I have had the privilege for a couple of decades now to call Kate Lohr my sister. And so I am thrilled to be able to tell you that you can't have her. She belongs to us, and we're going to keep her. So thank you for being here. Now, my task, right, you can applaud that. We love Kate Lohr. Now, because all of us have read Michelle Alexander's book, all of us now understand the interconnectedness of all these issues that we work on. There was a fabulous young man who created a companion guide to Michelle Alexander's book. And up, yep, and there it is. And as you can see, my copy looks like this. Because as an organizer, I am yellowing everything, right? Oh, I like that. Oh, I like that, right? Because I'm going to use it again. And so what I want to share with you in the 10 minutes I have is kind of what the four elements of a community social change agents are based on this book. But first, I want to dispel some myths. Because there are some that think movements are lit like a match, right? Like something happens and all of a sudden the civil rights movement started, right? And that's simply not true. Movements are the result of very specific leadership development and visioning and planning. They don't just happen because an event happened and all of a sudden you got a movement. So I want to dispel that one. I want to also dispel that movements require a heroic figure, right? We think that Dr. Martin Luther King led the civil rights movement if you only read what you get in your school, right? But if you know the reality of the civil rights movement, you know that there was a lot of mamas and papas and grandmamas and grandpapas and children who were on the front line of the civil rights movement. So when people tell you, oh, we can't move because we don't have like that leader, you are the leader you're looking for. There are those that will tell you that movements succeed if they mobilize mass actions, right? So when we put 10,000 people on the street, all of a sudden politicians are going to give, and they're going to give us exactly what we want. How many of us have participated in a whole lot of marches and still don't have what we want? All right. And so you are the witnesses that this, in fact, is not true. And so I wanted to start with dispelling those myths. So now that we've covered those, understanding your own role in social change, because every one of us have a role in moving a social change agenda. And this book that I refer to actually breaks it out into four different roles: the helper, the advocate, the rebel, and the organizer. And I'm going to go through each one, and then you can self-identify where you fit. Now, the helper are people who see an individual in need and try to meet that need, right? That's like typical church folk, right? Somebody's in need, you're like, okay, what can I do to help? However, helpers often provide direct services such as opening their homes, educating in job interviews, offering therapy for family members, feeding the hungry. They open their hearts and respond personally with the resources that they have available to them. So that's a helper. An advocate sees a need, but also sees that systems out there with resources, even if they are broken or unfair. Advocates help people navigate those systems, perhaps doing social work, public advocacy, or impacting litigation. They use knowledge of the system to help people fill their needs, bending the system so that it provides every ounce of justice or resources it can provide. So that's the advocate. The organizer. The organizer identifies root causes of community problems and brings people together who are most impacted by the problem with the belief they can build power to make change occur. Organizers often critique helpers and advocates for helping a broken system limp along rather than abolishing or changing it. And then there's the rebel. Rebels bring fire and energy and are willing to take risks that others may never even consider. They can be unyielding in pursuit of justice and willing to go through great personal sacrifice to make their point. Many political prisoners, for example, are rebels who came out of political and social movements and have gone on to teach people change is needed, and it often takes sacrifice to make it happen. Now, clearly, there is a role for all of us. Each role is vital to movement building, and each role has its own approach to change. Yet, these approaches can be a source of tension. Organizers get frustrated with helpers who don't connect their service work to larger issues. Rebels get angry with advocates who don't dream outside the current system. Advocates may be frustrated with organizers who don't value the real ways their advocacy helps make change. Or helpers can feel disconnected by rebels and feel the rebels' pounding insistence turn people off. Our job is to contribute our particular gifts to the movement, knowing that all are important, and trusting that others will fill in the spaces we are not called to fill. Thank you. And so,
I'm back.
And as you can imagine, I have been asked to talk specifically about the rebel role. Now, do you think I'm being typecast or something? I don't know. But let me tell you, the rebel speaks truth to power, no matter how painful it is for the power to hear that truth. Sometimes it's important to put it out there so that people understand this is the line. This is what we expect. Now, many times we know when I go and talk to the police chief or the mayor or the city council, I know that they are glazing over when I start talking about police accountability. Here she comes again. Oh, no. But guess what? About a year ago, wouldn't be a whole lot of people turning out for police accountability activity, right? Goes to show what a difference a few months make. All of a sudden, we have white middle-class America awakening to the fact that there's a problem. And the problem is unjust policing as it relates to African-American and other people who the police believe have no power. And so in my rebel role, I look for unlikely allies. It is absolutely amazing sometimes that I can find allies in police departments outside of Portland, because they don't want anybody to think that they're like Portland police. So they'll come and they'll tell me, hey, that's not us, right? Because we actually treat people with respect. We don't want to be Portland. We also look to build coalitions, because you know, a lot of times, the only way, in fact, change happens is when we build coalitions of unlikely allies. For example, I work with the AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform, which is a group that's been meeting for now over 13 years. We came together first after Kendra James was killed by Portland police here in Portland, which was 11 years ago, so no, we were before that. We came together before that. But we have been consistently working to change policy and practices since then. But guess what? We ally with gay lesbian organizations. We ally with youth groups. We ally with people that you would think, what? Those ministers are talking to who, right? And we do it because we understand the power of bringing coalitions together. And so that way, we build the force for the change we want. We had a fabulous meeting yesterday, the AMA Coalition Steering Committee, with Black Lives Matter, because we understand that they are the generation of here and now, right? And we are the generation that historically has been leading the effort. And we wanted to make sure that those young people knew that us elders are not here to stand in their way, but we're here to work with them to build the movement. And it was a powerful, powerful meeting. I got a secret to share with you. We did something wrong here in Portland. We invited the Department of Justice to come to Portland to investigate our police department. And I don't know about you, but like I'm from the day when the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice showed up. They meant business. They were going to stop discrimination. They were going to jail whoever they needed to jail. They were going to put an end to whatever it was you were trying to get them to fix. And so we were under this illusion, right? Bring the DOJ to town. Have them investigate the police. They will bring the hammer down on them. They will hold them accountable. Well, here's what we found. The Department of Justice has actually created the police departments that we all suffer under right now. In fact, they have incentivized arresting low-income people, homeless people, people of color, by giving them millions of dollars in federal grants to run the drug program, the anti-drug program, and the gang program, and the anti-gun program. Any program that police departments are now running, you can be assured that they got assistance from the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division to make that happen. And so I'm not saying don't bring the Department of Justice to your town. I'm saying be smarter than we were. We actually thought when they came up with a settlement agreement, it would actually fix what we found broken within the police department. Instead, they did a bait and switch. And the bait and switch was, rather than looking at how black men were being killed and harmed at the hands of the police, they baited and switched to, let's look at what's happening with people with mental health issues. And so, but the thing that we did right was we have standing in the federal court. No other community around the country who has had a Department of Justice investigation has standing in the federal court. The reason we got it was because we told the federal judge that the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division did not represent us. In fact, only we could represent us, and the federal judge agreed. And so it makes the city a little uncomfortable. It makes the DOJ a bit uncomfortable. It makes the police department want to scream. We, in fact, have equal standing in the court. So anytime this issue goes in front of the federal court, the AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform will be there. I will, yes. And so I will close by saying, being a rebel doesn't mean I have to jump on the table and jump up and down and say bad words to people. What it means is that I have to be firm and clear about what my ask is, because as we know, if power secedes nothing without a demand, it never has, it never will. Thank you.
I feel totally intimidated. I'm responsible for representing the helper role, and I think it's a fairly good embodiment of the relationship between helping and the rebel. I feel like a fairly dim bulb compared to Joanne's passion. But we do have a role, and it's a very important one. My name's Doug Cooper. I'm with Mercy Corps Northwest, and we run the Reentry Transition Center, and like Sandy said, it's hard to hear me. Oh, don't make me stand up. Okay, now it's even worse. So Mercy Corps Northwest operates the Reentry Transition Center, which is actually about 8 blocks up the street. I'm not going to bend down. I can spoke up. All right. Appreciate the coaching. Thank you. It does. So Mercy Corps Northwest, who I work for, represents, operates the Reentry Transition Center, which is actually about 8 blocks up the street, and is also the service project for the General Assembly this year. The RTC sees about 1,000 people a year, coming out of county jail, federal prison, state prison. and our job is to help them to create productive, secure lives as they return to the community. As an organization, as Mercy Corps Northwest, our understanding and our involvement in the issue of incarceration and reentry has been very evolutionary. It wasn't something we chose strategically. It was really a response to the relationship of the people that we were working with. And our involvement began when we started teaching classes at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, which is Oregon's only prison for women, about 20 miles south of Portland. As an organization, our specialty was small business development, and we proposed to the corrections department to go into the prison and teach women about entrepreneurship and self-employment. From our perspective at that point, we were just giving them an option for economic security. There was a lot of interest. The class took off. We've been teaching there since 2007. But as our women started to graduate and started to release to the community, we learned two things pretty quickly, both that were very surprising to us just because of our ignorance of the issues. First is what we were really teaching was hope. It wasn't business, and it wasn't self-employment. It was the hope that they could have some control on building secure and productive lives for themselves after they released. The second thing that we learned were the obstacles they ran into after they released. We were just completely unprepared for the amount of frustration, the difficulties, the roadblocks, the obstacles that they encountered after they released. And remember, these were women that we'd worked with from a year and a half or 2 years. We knew that they were very sincere about changing their lives. We knew that they wanted to do nothing more than get back to the community, build stable lives, be good parents, have good jobs, pay taxes. And we knew they were willing to work hard for it. And when they returned to the community and ran after roadblock after roadblock after roadblock, we saw them get frustrated. We saw them get worn down. We saw them start to return to old habits and their old community and to old ways of living that basically got them where they started with in the prison to start with. And it just seemed to us like a terrible waste, not only of their potential, of their hopes they had for their family, but also of the resources that the community had invested in them, that we had invested in them, and their own hopes and dreams. So what we were not prepared to be able to step in and provide all of their needs. We weren't a social service agency, but we did know there were a lot of partners around Portland in the Multnomah County area that provided those services. So systemically, what we were seeing was a huge need on this side and a lack and resources on the other side that were actually available and a lack of a bridge in between. So our response to that was to start the Reentry Transition Center. And it became the mission of the Transition Center to do four things. First, to build a relationship with those participants, to know that they had somebody on their side, that somebody was working in their behalf, that they were important. Second of all, to help them identify the challenges that they had as they were running into those obstacles and roadblocks. The third is to get them to the right resources that were already existing out there in the community. And the fourth was to support them along the way, because that path is not always real straight, it's not always real clear, and it is often very, very frustrating. So that model of coordinating resources has been, it's been very successful, both from a financial perspective. a recent third-party evaluation showed that we created $14 in savings to the public safety system for every dollar that was invested in the program. We've reduced recidivism over 30% compared to a control group. And most importantly, we have lots and lots of stories from our participants about their changed lives. The deeper lesson that we really have learned in this is it's really a story of community, about acceptance and reconciliation, because many, many, many of these people grew up in communities and a culture of criminality, some by just their family, some by their choice, but at this point, they're ready for a change, and they've learned that the community that they're coming from, the one that they know, the one that they're want to move out from, has been destructive to them, it's been destructive to their families and to the community at large. But the question is, what do you move into? When you live in a culture, when you live in a community, moving into something else can often be very difficult. And often when you're in that in-between zone, when you want to move out of one and you want to be in the other, you're in no man's land, and it's very uncomfortable, and it can be very frustrating, and it can be a very lonely place. The role of the RTC, the Reentry Transition Center, at that point is we are a transitional community. That is our actually, despite all the services that we provide, despite all the resources that we can direct them to, we've come to learn that our biggest function is as a transitional community that allows them to understand that they can move out of their old lives and then they can put a foot into their new life as part of our community. So as our roles, especially seeing how we are members of faith-based communities with basic principles around reconciliation and forgiveness, I think our role is pretty clear in the community. You know, we can be the welcoming side on the other end. We can actually reach out and say, you're important to us, we welcome you back to the community. And despite all of the absolute need for those services, the real power is in feeling that you're cared about, that you belong, and that people are there welcoming you.
Speech. Hi, I'm Shannon. Is the volume okay? Are we good?
No.
Okay. I will try and be louder and you can tell me if I'm screaming at you. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm Shannon White. I'm the deputy director at an organization here in Oregon called Partnership for Safety and Justice. And we are a really unique organization in the country in that we advocate for reforming our public safety and criminal justice system, both for people convicted of crime and victims of crime. We believe that and know that our public safety system touches both those people's lives very intensely, and that right now a lot of harm is being done. So we try and advocate for policies that will help everyone, and also recognizing that, quite frankly, a lot of folks that are in the system end up on both sides of that victimization and ending up incarcerated. You know, for example, a child who's neglected and abused might become a teenager who does drugs, who then ends up incarcerated. So that's what we do. I am excited to be here, and I'm excited that there's even a conversation happening about ending the new Jim Crow, right? And really what we need to do for our criminal justice system. I know it will be hard to believe when you look at me, but I've been working to end mass incarceration in one capacity or another for over 20 years. Unfortunately, under my watch, the number of people in prison has quadrupled. So we have not had our moment of victory yet, but there have been a few of us, many right here, fighting this battle for a long time, and we know we are in an incredible moment for change. And I think part of what I want to talk to you about is that in this moment, I am worried that there is actually more momentum for change than there is a united vision for what the change will look like. And when we think about, if for those of you who are familiar with Michelle's book, she really talks to us about the historic and racist sort of foundations of our current criminal justice system, right? And she says, so we had slavery and that ended. So we got Jim Crow. Jim Crow ended and we got mass incarceration. Now, as we work to end mass incarceration, what do we want? We have to answer that question, or, as she warns, we will end up with some other form of racist, classist, social control. So I want to tell you about what we've been doing in Oregon, but first I also want to think about how we got to this moment as a kind of a cautionary tale of how we're going to seize it. So even before the tragedies in Ferguson and York and other places, before this sort of Black Lives Matter moment, for the first time in decades, we were seeing a decline in the prison population. And that was a remarkable moment for those of us who'd been working for decades for that moment. For some of us, you know, it came because we knew the system was racist and dehumanizing and that people deserved better. But for others, it was a fiscal reality, right? That's what changed minds. So Texas enacted, you know, massive sentencing reforms, not because they were convinced that that was the right thing to do necessarily, but because it was an economic reality for their state. They were online to build more prisons, and they just couldn't afford to do it. Oregon, similarly, in 2013, and we were part of this effort, passed a sentencing reform bill that flatlined our prison growth because we were just about to have to build a new prison. And so when you think about that, there's an economic reality to why we're in a moment where we can create change, that has to guide how we seize this change. And I think, as the advocate, I didn't say I'm here playing the advocate role, which I do and we do. We are trying to think about not just how, I mean, I'm assuming most of you agree with us up on this panel, but I think part of what we have to do in this moment is not just change the system, but change the minds of people who we haven't yet convinced, right? Because otherwise this change will not be long-lasting, it will not be sustained, it will not be anti-racist and anti-classist. And so what we do, and you'll hear about the interesting ways in which we do it, is try and change not just the landscape, but also to change minds. So the bill that I talked about here in Oregon in 2013 that we passed that prevented us from needing to build a new prison is kind of an interesting case study and also is reflective of reforms that are happening across the country. 26 states have done similar reforms. Texas is one of them. And they call it justice reinvestment. And the idea is that you basically stop sending millions of dollars into prisons and take that money and get it back into local communities. So in Oregon, we didn't build a prison in Junction City, and we've taken now tens of millions of dollars and reinvested it at the local level so counties can make choices about how they address their own public safety needs. And we also, because we pushed hard for it, are the only state of all those states who did justice reinvestment who allocated funding for victim services as well. So when that law passed, the political reality was that for it to pass, it had to be way watered down from what we wanted. And we were deeply disappointed in the reforms we didn't get. But the bottom line was at least we weren't building a new prison, and that was something to be thankful for. But the interesting thing is it was so watered down because the politicians needed to get law enforcement signed on in support. So for that bill to pass, they got the district attorneys, the sheriffs, and the police all signed on in support. At the time, we were just mortified. We'd lost our bill. We'd lost it to the people who were sending all the folks to prison. It was just, you know, it was disheartening. But then to continue the reforms, right, you need to continue the financial investment back to the communities. And that's a fight because there's other things that need money, education, healthcare. And so when we came back this session, as it turned out, we came back with a coalition that we've had for years of unlikely allies, which has included business and victims and education and labor and human services. But now we were also back with the people who'd signed on to the bill. The police chiefs, the sheriffs, the district attorneys, people who we were always oppositional to before. And just a month ago, all those groups, the law enforcement groups, our other coalition allies, we came to the Capitol together, 70 of us. We visited over half of Oregon's legislators under a banner of United for Justice to talk about why we didn't need to send people to prison, why we needed to invest in local communities, and why these investments need to be sustained so we could actually change our public safety course in Oregon. Now, I'm not saying this is like a kumbaya moment between our organization and law enforcement, but part of what we do in our advocacy role is look for the common ground we have. That doesn't mean we're gonna disagree on many, many things. Some of my law enforcement Republican legislative champions sometimes say things that make me want to jump off a bridge. but you know, we're finding common ground because we believe that if we don't start chipping away at changing the minds of the people who have opposed us, that we will lose this moment and we won't get a vision for justice that's the kind of thing that we can believe in and embrace. So one of the things about those reforms is they didn't impact women as much as men. And so this session, we were about to have to open a closed prison for women and to have a second prison in Oregon just for women, which was a horrifying prospect. And so we brought a concept forward that actually is around parents, custodial parents, being that would be sentenced to prison if they have their children, they're prioritized to be diverted from prison, held accountable locally so they can stay with their kids, get the other treatment and services they need, and then also get support to make their families stronger. I mean, everything from this program, like, has people teaching them, like, read to your kids at night, let's all have dinner together. I mean, really, I think, innovative stuff. And usually, if sentencing reform comes up, all those law enforcement people, you know, jump up and say no. And this time they said, you know, we know that we can do justice differently. We know that we can do it better. We don't need to spend $20 million to open up a unit for women at the Oregon State Prison. Let's divert these women from prison, keep them united with their families in their communities. And knock on wood, that bill has not passed yet. But it looks like it's gonna pass. Right now we have, in the House, we have 19 Republican sponsors who have traditionally been opposed to these kinds of reforms. And so that's the kind of advocacy that we're doing, that we think is about creating the long-term vision we need to have in this moment. And to be clear, like, justice reinvestment is not our vision of a perfect reform. It is a stepping stone. Like, we know that there meant much, we need to go much, much deeper, but we also know that we need to bring people along with us who have traditionally not been there. And so I just want to say that, again, reminding ourselves that what Michelle Alexander said, that if we don't have a, well, what she said was that we went from slavery to Jim Crow to mass incarceration, and we are going to be the people who define what comes next. And so we need to work hard and work together to create a vision for what that looks like so we don't create the next Jim Crow. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Kate Lohr, and I'm the social justice minister at First Unitarian Church, and I just want to ask you something. Okay, First Unitarian Church is a large church, and we can do a lot, but can you see the difference of what we can do when we're working in partnerships like this? Right? We are a major force in town. Just ask, you know, we've talked about four different types of ways to engage in change. We've got the helper, the advocate, the rebel, and the organizer. I'm the organizer. I'm the one representing at least that role, because of course we all have parts of all of that in us, right? And as an organizer, I want to know who's in the house. If you had to pick one of those categories, helper, advocate, rebel, organizer, I'm going to ask you to raise your hand as I say that category. Let's hear it for the helpers. Good. Let's hear it for the advocates. Good. Let's hear it for the rebels. Good. Let's hear it for the organizers. Yes, this is exactly who we need to be in the room right now. We need each other. And Unitarians, I want to say that we often choose one or the other, right? When I look around the country and I see that we're doing, I see that we are natural-born helpers and that we're natural-born advocates, that we do some organizing. We're certainly rebellious. But if I was to share with you honestly my reflection, I would say that we organize around certain things and not others. And what I mean is we organize each other to give testimonies in public places in front of elected officials. We organize to circulate petitions, and we show up when we're asked to for political rallies. Am I right? We are really good in that. Now, what I want to suggest is that when we show up like that, except for perhaps when the rallies, we often show up as experts. We often show up as leaders. And what I want to ask you to reflect upon today is what would this work look like if we did all of those things, but that we did so cognizant that we are part of the dominant class and race, largely, there are clearly exceptions. What would it look like if we came with those skills but started first with relationships with people most impacted, right? That's one of the areas. I mean, I have to say, more and more of our kids are ending up in prison, right? Some of us have family members. Some of us here have probably been in prison. But largely, that's not the case. And so one of the risks that we run when we try to help or try to advocate, or even if we're out there being rebels and we don't have relationships with the people most impacted, we can accidentally perpetuate the very oppression that we're fighting. So this workshop is about creating partnerships. And the reason why we chose to focus on that is because it's the partnerships that lead us into relationships. For instance, Joanne, our rebel, she's also, I'm a state legislator, she's also so many other things, right? But she is really good at being the rebel. I work with her on that police accountability. And I am so well-bred, and I have been doing this work for so long, and I am constantly reminded of how naive I am. I thought the DOJ were the good guys, right? I'm working with Joanne on the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform. And I thought perhaps that I could actually be of service by being a human rights commissioner in the city of Portland. But what I learned that I couldn't learn unless I was in partnership with people more impacted by mass incarceration is that despite my greatest efforts, I am blind to the realities. And that politicians lie regularly. The police and the DOJ support one another. They know one another. They have relationships, right? So they cover each other. And so if I was to leave you with one message today, it would be to please, I mean, because our congregations, and there are exceptions, because our congregations tend to be populated with a dominant culture, a dominant race, that we owe it to ourselves and to the movement to end New Jim Crow that we step outside the walls of our church and cultivate authentic relationships. And then, thank you. Now, when we do that, we run some risks, right? Because one of the first things that you do when you cultivate relationships with people from different cultures and races, etc., is that you accidentally commit microaggressions. You step in it. You say the wrong thing. You come across as stupid. Somebody shames you. And you feel bad. So you don't want to do that, right? I'll just stay with my like-minded people inside the safety of the walls of my church. But this is why, if we are really interested in ending the new Jim Crow, we must all commit to anti-racism work. And not just one course. I've been doing it since I was 19, and I'm not telling you how old I am now. I am still learning, right? I am still learning. This work never ends. So if we're serious, we not only need to develop authentic relationships, we have to minimize the harm that we might accidentally do by our microaggressions. And lastly, we need to cultivate humility. We are so used to being in positions of power. We know how to be efficient in building meetings. We are idea people. We love to just jump to the front, raise our hand and say, I'll do that. But if we're serious about ending mass incarceration and being part of it, like we have been such a part of marriage equity, I would like to suggest that it's our turn to follow and not just lead. And when we're asked to lead, lead. But if we're going to maintain those relationships with people most impacted, we have to be willing to follow Black and Brown leadership. Right. So within our churches, we organizers in the room, we need to keep in mind those four categories because we need all four of them. There's room for everyone in this work, and it's so easy to dismiss the rebels. It's so easy to dismiss the helpers and saying, oh, you're just about charity, man. We're not about charity, we're about justice. We're not gonna do that, right? We have to honor the fact that we need all four types of activists in this movement. Together, we have to work together to bring that vision that is emerging from the future as we do this, but is not yet clear, and we need to stay in partnerships. Thank you very much. And one last little quick thing, because I'm an organizer, I'm always thinking of the big picture. We do have a gentleman here who has a clergy letter to sign on for a new drug policy, since it's the drug policies that are feeding. So I'm not going to ask you to speak. I'm just asking you to stand, right? Talk to this man. If you're a clergy person, you want to know more about it. He's got all the information you might need. Thank you.
Okay, so we knew we didn't have an outline to give you about how to go and do this perfectly, because every place we are is different. But we wanted to paint a broad picture of what it's like in Portland. We wanted you to know that there are groups back in your states like Reentry Transition Center, and we have a book of those downstairs in booth 406. If you don't know who does reentry in your state or your city, come by, get out your smartphone, take a picture. We wanted you to know about advocacy agencies, and there, Shannon's put a link to larger organizations that you can find on the information that will be on the website. So now we'd like to give you an opportunity to ask questions. And the key word in that is question. And so there's a mic here in the center.
One question only, please.
Please, yeah, one question. You can direct it to someone on the panel or to the panel in general. Thank you.
My name is Lonnie Mosley. I'm from the Unitarian Universalist Church of Berkeley in California. And I want to say to my brothers and sisters here sincerely, I thank you. I truly, truly thank you for what you're doing. And the question is, I read the Black Codes in Wikipedia. You know, some of them are, but you need to read the Black Codes about what was done years ago, as they're talking about after, you know, enslavement ended and Jim Crow started. And so I think we need a fifth advocate, but I'm just putting it out there, of someone who manages the media. The reason why we have these incarceration and the is the fear of the face. But that was developed over time when the Black Codes were, you couldn't even walk down without being incarcerated. So then those people went to prison, and then they became, you know, more and more institutionalized. So the question is, could we get a fifth role of advocate so that we could say, have posters that say, do you know how you became to fear this face? Do you know where we help people know how this happened, as well as all the other roles that we're dealing with?
So I think my response to that would be that
It's not that we need a fifth one. Each of the four should be educating people about whatever the current condition is, whether you're a helper or organizer or a rebel. Part of the role is actually to be educating the people that you're interacting with. And as far as the media messaging is concerned, at least here in Portland, a lot of the media messaging is driven by the police bureau, who sends press releases out all day, every day, giving a visual of what crime looks like, who's committing it, what neighborhoods it's happening in. And I can assure you that their vision of criminality is not the reality of what's happening on the ground. But so as the public, all you do is get what you see on the evening news, and you don't understand that they're framing the conversation so that you have that fear of black men. You have that fear when you see three or four black boys walking down the street. They must be a gang because you have been conditioned by the media to see black men in that light.
Next question.
I guess I would just add quickly, yes to what Joanne said, but also yes to your question, which is, you know, there are coordinated strategies of communication to get certain images out there. And I think under the advocate role, there is a role for a bunch of other things, including litigation strategies, but I think particularly a communication strategy. And again, it's something we have to get unified behind. We need consistent messaging that we're all using if we're going to change minds. We can't all be spouting off whatever we think is the best message at the moment, because that's not going to win the day. And so, yes, we need a strong, I think, visionary communication strategy about what we want that we're all beginning to use so that we're moving in the right direction.
I'm Steve Buckingham, lay community minister, and with the Unitarian Universalist Legislative Ministry of Maryland. So I'm pretty comfortable with the advocacy part, but I didn't get a real good idea of how you organized. I know there's lots of different ways of doing it with Gamaliel and PICO and other professional organizations that do fundraising and staff. Is that what you did in Portland, or did you do it yourself? And what were the lessons you learned? I came to learn.
Good question. What I did was I started showing up to events that were coordinated by people most impacted. I went to the meetings and saw who were the players. I got on Facebook groups and started seeing who was doing what. And then I started going to their meetings. By going to meetings outside of my church, then I was able to develop the relationships that led to the partnerships. Oh, well, sure. I'll use for an example the meetings of protests and vigils held around police shootings of unarmed black men, right? And then I started hearing about Shannon's group. Actually, it started with her group. because they were involving people who had been incarcerated and giving them empowered roles and started letting them meet in the church. Right? Yeah. So bringing them in so that to facilitate our members connecting with members here and so forth.
Some other great examples, like right now for 5 years we've been doing a monthly vigil, Justice for Keith Notice, who was a 24-year-old black man who was shot and killed by the police. The only reason he was pulled over was because, and I'm quoting the police officer, he looked like he might be a gang member, and he died, dead. And so his dad started the month after Keaton was killed having a vigil on the corner of Northeast 6th and Halsey on the 12th of each month to make sure that people didn't forget his son. And I met him on the worst week of his life, the week his son was killed by Portland police. sometimes when people have suffered that kind of tragedy, the best you can do is just be there with them. And so I would show up once a month. Sometimes it'd be three of us. Sometimes it'd be 30 of us. Sometimes there's 100. Sometimes not. He died last October. Fred did.
The dad.
And I believe the dad is another death at the hands of the police, because he worked so hard seeking justice for his son that his heart gave out. The good news about this story is that the vigil continues. It still happens every month, still happens on the 12th. Keith Notice and now his dad, Fred Bryant, are honored by the community. So once a year, we do a celebration of their life. The good news is that Black Lives Matters now wants to do a community grand jury about that particular case. So you never know where the help will come from. Some days just showing up, being present, being empathetic, actually creates the opportunity for more.
I just want to add a couple more specifics. Also, this again was organized by people of color to participate in what in interracial dialogues, right, which are often offered in communities, to go to that. And there was one more. Oh, yeah, and then once we meet folks, invite them into our church for forums so that we help build bridges between our church and communities outside, and then support them. So we share our Sunday plate with organizations each month. And so we support the agencies that we partner with our funds, and that means something. Right? And then lastly, one of the things we've done in Portland is we've come to understand what's called the school-to-prison pipeline. And we have gone into historically Black communities to hear about what's happening and then offering our service. Like my own husband helped when a 5-year-old Black boy was being suspended because he had a Lego gun in his backpack. Suspension. Once that's on your record, man, that's the very first step for the school-to-prison pipeline. So he took his articulate self and his rebellious spirit, and he met with that principal, and boy, that boy got freed. So there is a time for that advocate. There's a time for the rebel. There's a time for us all.
So we also work with a group, Portland Parent Union, which is organized by an African-American woman. And they have joined the Dignity with Schools campaign, which is active in many states. So if you're interested in ending that school-to-prison pipeline and disrupting it, look up Dignity for Schools again on the resource list when you finally can get your hands on it.
My name is Claire DeRoche. I'm from the UU congregation at Shelter Rock in Long Island. My question is directed to Shannon, but anybody else on the panel, please feel free to help me with this. I'm wondering if the next step in the slavery, Jim Crow, mass incarceration chain is what the private prison system is doing in terms of parole and probation and reentry services. I'd just be interested to hear what you have to say about that. Thank you.
Sure. I mean, I think the private, luckily here in Oregon, we don't have that kind of privatization, but I lived and worked in Louisiana for 14 years, and we did have that kind of privatization, and certainly the pure business greed associated with the privatization of prisons and other services is a horrible incentive to keep the system in place. So certainly joining, if you're in states that have that kind of privatization, joining campaigns to end them is good. I just, again, want to remind us all to think about when they're gone, what else, right? We can't just do away with the public safety system, even if we might want to. We've got to have some some answers for what comes next.
Yeah, I want to speak to that a little bit. So we need to keep in mind that there is the visible structural system that creates some of these inequities, but there's also an invisible cultural side of it that we all reflect. And the business community can actually help break that down. And to the extent that you have business owners within your congregations, or if you are a business owner, if you are willing to step over that barrier and employ somebody as a second chance, it's a concrete, definite thing that you can do that has benefits across this line, and it starts to break down those invisible cultural stereotypes that reinforce the visible structural ones. So it's very concrete, and there's a lot of potential in small and mid-sized and large employers taking that risk and stepping over those invisible barriers and employing people that have had criminal histories.
My name is Michael Richardson. I'm with the First Unitarian Congregational Society in Brooklyn. And my question is, how do you deal with groups or organizations that show up at a rally or a function or something, and they are nothing to do with what the rally is about? They're trying to promote their own agenda, which is something different.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have a couple of those. We got people that show up with their banners, you know, when you got thousands of people on the street and they want to get up front where the cameras are so that it appears that they've organized the effort. I think Kate's much nicer than I am about it. I just tell them they have to move to the side. I make sure that if I'm organizing an event that we're not distracted by people who come with their own agenda. We certainly have experienced that. I think we try to be very clear that they're welcome to be a part, but you don't get to actually like walk up front and put your banner in the very beginning when you've done absolutely no work to organize it. But so maybe, I think, you know, it's good to hang around with ministers. I hang around with a lot of ministers, so they help me be nicer, right?
I want to just say we had a really good example of that. Yes. I'm lapsing the name. The one in front of the Justice Center? Oh, I was thinking of the Justice Center, right? So we had the situation in which the person who had the chokehold, whose name I don't know why, has just disappeared. Michael Brown. Thank you. Eric Gardner, so I'm not the only one. All right, we're going to, that's right, there are too many to remember them all the time. When it was, when the officers were not charged, we had a huge rally in Portland. And it was the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition that saw this coming, and we had it organized in advance so that there was, you know, we would just say that the next day after that is announced, we will meet at the Justice Center. Okay, yes. And so we are all gathered. We've got 4,000 or so people. And we are trying to be inclusive and have partnerships. And then some of the people who came up started speaking in a very revolutionary manner. And we did our big walk and we came back. And our event was over, but they wanted to take over the town, right? So we were faced with that. How do we stay, you know, we have allies, but they were taking that momentum that we had built with our efforts, and they wanted to go block all the highways. They wanted to, you know, go be a rabble-rousing group. And there's room for that, but it's not what we organized. So luckily we had a leader with a cool head who said, okay, now we are going to hold up our phones, because it was nighttime by this time, and with our flashlights on, as candlelights in remembering of the 4 hours he was left on the street before anybody could attend to him. And in that 4 minutes, he was like thinking, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And he just said, okay, those of us who organized this, our event is now over, and we are exiting this way. And our responsibility, what happened, ends now. And everybody else, you go that way, and, you know, and good luck to you. So that's what we did, and they did end up closing the freeways down, and there were
What, was there a few broken windows? Yeah, as, and we were able to distinguish ourselves from that.
Okay, we are running out of time. We'll take one more question and hopefully one more quick answer. And then you're welcome to stay, but there is another workshop in here at 3. So mingle, talk with each other.
No pressure, right?
No pressure. The perfect question.
I'm Amber with UU Davis, and I'm just so grateful that we have this panel to have these tough discussions. And I'm a rebel. And I've had the privilege of attending several different UU congregations from upstate New York to Albuquerque to Oakland to Sacramento to Davis now. And as you pointed out, Kate, I mean, it's predominantly over 50 white, middle-class educated congregants, which having come from a previously racially diverse and ethnically diverse congregation, I found really astounding considering we have such a progressive agenda. And I've heard people asking questions which were more about like, why aren't there more people of color, instead of asking different questions such as, how can we be more welcoming? How can we create coalitions and alliances? And I'm just wondering if you could speak to some ways that we as a denomination or congregation can help build those bridges. As I think you already have quite a bit. So
somebody passed us a note, Susan, who may know...
Leslie,
who may know more info. Yes, Susan, you've been outed. That tell people about Nation Inside, which is a fabulous national hub website that finds partners around the country resources. Great stuff, she says. And so it's called Nation Inside. I also would like to mention, since I still have the mic in my hand, that there is an event on Monday for those of you who will still be here at Warren Pacific College called Race, Faith, and Justice in the Age of Ferguson in Baltimore. Reverend Sekou will be on the panel as well as myself and a couple of other individuals. Starts at 7 to 9 p.m. It's free and open to the public. We expect a large crowd at that event, and it should be a stimulating conversation.
Okay, Susan Leslie, you're in the room, so stand up. In case people don't know Susan, she's with the Witness Ministry Program of the UUA. She does this work every single day. She's got some materials in the back and some small Black Lives Matters buttons. So feel free to mingle for a little while, but eventually the next group will come in and kick you out. So thank you.
Second meeting.
And please
two people were chosen to meet with the administration.
Right. Sure.
Language. So me, and Karen Kosher, African American, not like you.
Right.
Thank you so much. Algebra teacher who wanted to teach Ebonics in this anonymous. So that's where I met her. At the end of the year, we were best friends.
Oh, very cool.
She was a minister, blah, 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 blah.
From this workshop, we gathered a lot of resources and information.
Asked me several years later when she was still at Claremont getting her PhD, she said, so who's doing the work with the black folks from that committee? I said, just me, Karen, and we became buddies. But Betty, it was hard because we're so different, but she's my sister.
All right.
We do things but. I've been a member of the NAACP since 1980.
Right.
So recently I retired, I had more time.
Right.
I went to the meeting. I went for 2 years.
Right.
They go along to get along.
Right.
That's who our NAACP is. They don't do it right. But what we got now, we have faith in community.
Right.
Which is, finally, we've worked together. Interfaith people and faith in community, and we have African American pastors on the west side who are beginning to look at. We need better education. You know, we'll work, but they're the boss. That's the issue.
Wonderful.
They are the boss, but you could do it here. Because of the coming together of who you have. But it is not a white people's business.
Right.
We
I
can
understand.
Help,
right.
But thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to put her in touch with you.
Feel free.
Our NAACP president is now a woman, and she may be more responsive than the guys who wanted to get along.
To get along.
With the,
so,
bye-bye.
But just know that I will be in Philly for the National Convention next month. So from July 12th through the 16th, so let her know. If she's going to be in Philly, we should connect.
And streets.
I will.
But you're welcome.
So that your cell phone's there?
Yes, it is.
Oh, what a beautiful gift to me, Joanne.
All right.
Thank you.
You are very welcome. Pleasure to meet with you. How are you?
I used to live in Portland. I just got here last Saturday. I just wanted to thank you for the oratorium. It's in the Oregonian.
Yes.
Well, thank you.
That's
going to lead another workshop.
Yes.
Because, you know, all I'm reading is that you've got to show up, not take over, which is very
African. Yes. The great news, the great news is we had an NAACP meeting and they were standing room only. I left there to get here. Standing room was fabulous. So thank you for that.
But I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Yes, that's right.
Thank you.
And it worked. And so you should know it worked because the room was
active. I'm going to take that back to Austin.
Yes. Tell them it worked.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Hi.
How are you?
Oh, fine. I don't even know you. You were for. I met you off and on. Terry Dillon, the Amnesty.
Oh, cool. Yes.
And a year ago, over a year ago, I organized work with your predecessor to bring the author
for me, it's easy, and for us, because a clergy.
Oh, yes.
We're committed to nonviolence.
All I want to say is, when
so,
I found out you were the president of
so,
the God,
yeah,
I said,
so
oh, yeah! Because I almost stepped in. She asked me to help organize the October event, but my little red flags were going up.
And so
I didn't know
when
the
it comes
details,
to
but
talking about
she was more flaky.
Forward,
I don't know what.
Have, well, to articulate.
And
that's why.
The only thing I can say right now is, I'm part of this little church. I want
to
do like you're saying.
Yes.
See,
media press
I've always been, I can lead or I can follow. And I'm so glad you're here. I'd like to talk more.
Wonderful. Did I give you my card? You have it? Excellent. All right, then.
The other one thing, though, are you guys working on your website stuff?
We do have a website, but you know the challenge is that if you put in the NAACP, the old one comes up.
I come up the old one,
so
and I can't find the new one.
It is PortlandNAACP1120.org. PortlandNAACP1120.org. And we're also on Facebook.
That's where we have
Portland,
to
use. Portland Anti-Hate.
No,
I'm Gigi. Hi. Okay, thank
that's
you.
Where
is
we
the standing decision published?
And there's,
the,
I mean, there's
the,
those who say
yes.
There's a role for Malcolm,
okay.
There's a role
and
for Martin Luther King.
What's the name of the
King?
It's on the Department of Justice
the Civil Rights
website,
happened because they were
and
involved,
it's the,
but
it's
I
the it's the DOJ versus the City of Portland.
Got it.
So that's the case.
Has anybody else to acknowledge?
Tried that?
Tried that?
No, no, which is
okay.
why I am excited about making sure that people know, because right, you know, with Ferguson and Baltimore and all the other cases.
And did you find, is even Holder's Justice
Washington
Department?
Yes,
I'm
he was. Holder was still there.
I'm a retired Justice Department.
Uh-huh.
And I was a criminal prosecutor.
Right. Okay. Way too much knowledge.
No, but I also have a lot of issues, personal issues around.
Good.
Well,
actually,
we need to
raise
my heart.
The next group
is
oh, we got
to
go.
At least,
let's
start.
I have another
workshop.
Yeah.
Well, that's
yeah. Even under Eric, I worked there.
Yeah.
Baby lawyer.
Well, I tell you, he was.
Oh,
he was set
more.
Yeah.
In a short time, he was there.
We'll see you later. Thank you.
Then happened, as you know.
Oh, well, it was a disaster.
Oh, yeah. Under Bush, there were no investors.
Can I have my poster?
Oh, okay. Yes, yes.
Yes.
As long as
okay.
I can get it back. I'm leaving.
So, off the stage.
Okay,
anyway.
So I'll look for
so
the
taking us out. Yes.
We'll check. So I have to go leave
okay.
for another workshop, and then I'm going to do this public witness. And
okay.
then
I'm trying
to. When are we meeting?
Yeah,
I would like to. What
so
time do you want to meet?
I
think I'll go home through the husband, make sure he's cool, and then come back.
Well, if you start at 8, you want to like, get together at
6:30?
6:30.
Let's go somewhere walking distance where we could just, yeah, somewhere
we'll
close.
Text.
Okay, all right.
I really
sounds like a plan. Hi there. Sorry, we're getting out of your way.
It's all right.
We're moving. I know, yeah.
Like, I'm running out. Oh my God, it's finally over.
Did you get it?
Service project?
Yeah.
So that's been. Booth 406. Reentry transition center, reentry prison. Yeah, it's a great project. So Sunday morning offering is, you just have to get through Sunday morning offering and count the money. So, yeah, that's great.
So John
Oh, is he really?
Oh, I'm not the person. I'm from the next
look
from Sherry left, but we look similar.
Erica's here.
But I'm Nicole, and I bet you're looking for Kate Laurie and Sherry left. It's called Liturgical Pedagogy, so about teaching our hearts. Yeah. I don't know if I have one. I think I left it at the booth. I apologize.
I mean, Sophie is.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Somewhere, but I haven't seen her at all.
Oh, and Becky. Becky.
Oh, Becky.
Yes,
yeah.
I've seen Becky and Linda.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Oh, Mark Levin is around. I passed Mark in the hall. Didn't speak to him. Are you having thank you
sure.
so